Hello and welcome to CorpusCast. You're listening to the podcast all about corpus linguistics and what it can do for society. Each episode, we'll explore how the study of language in large corpora is used to tackle challenges in the world relating to education, health, and technology, among many others. So sit back, relax, and join us as we discover the ways in which corpus linguistics is shaping the future of the study of language. I am your host, Robbie Love, and I am a corpus linguist at Aston University. Today's topic is the role of corpus linguistics in the study of academic writing, something that will be very familiar to many of our listeners who are researchers and students in corpus linguistics and writing academic work for publication or assessment. Academic writing can be a difficult genre of writing to learn, relatively formal with many rather rigid conventions, and there are also many disciplinary variations both within and across languages that add to the difficulty. So research in this area seeks, among other things, to better understand how language is used in this context to help people develop in their academic writing. And my guest today is Dr. Kevin Jian, who is a distinguished professor in applied linguistics in the School of Foreign Language Education at Jilin University in China. Kevin's research interests include disciplinary discourse, corpus studies, and English for academic purposes and English for specific purposes. And his publications have appeared widely in major applied linguistics journals. And he's published books on academic writing, including on meta-discursive nouns and academic discourse and global publishing with his mentor and former PhD supervisor, Ken Hyland. So I'm really looking forward to chatting with Kevin, another guest that I've never met in person, but I'm sure we'll have a really interesting conversation about his work with academic discourse and corpus linguistics. So please welcome to CorpusCast my guest for today's episode, Kevin Jiang. Hello, Kevin. Great to see you.
Hello, Robbie. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share and talk about the way I use corpora in my research into disciplinary writing and academic discourse. Thank you so much, Robbie.
Well, thank you so much for coming onto the show. I know that, you know, this it takes, you know, out of your busy schedule. I know that you're in a hotel on a work trip at the moment. So I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and have a chat with me. So thank you so much. With that in mind, we'll get started so we can learn more about you and your work.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Oh, yeah, of course. No, thank you. What does corpus linguistics mean to you?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think corpus linguistics is so different from other branches of linguistics or other hyphenated branches of linguistics, like social linguistics and psycholinguistics, because the names of these linguistics suggest the first part of the names, like it's just the first part of the names is the things that we study in these branches of linguistics, like social linguistics looks at the relation between language and society, psycholinguistics look at the relation between a language use and psychological processing. But in corpus linguistics, I think corpus is not the things we are studied in these branches of linguistics, but it is the method that we use in our language research. So corpus is a method, not just a tool. It's also associated with a certain outlook we take on language. And I think the simple and the concise definition of a corpus is a large collection of naturally occurring language used in a given context. And to me, as a researcher using corpus linguistics, we believe this is a source of how we understand the language. And so we use corpus in our search of academic language in different contexts to look at language use across disciplines, across genres in academic contexts. So I think this is what corpus linguistics to me. Thank you, Robbie.
Thank you. And I think we'll keep thanking each other throughout this episode. That's really interesting. We will return to that debate later on, the question of the climb between, or the continuum between method and theory. For now, though, I'd love to hear more about your own academic background. Where did you study, and what led you to your current position at Jilin University?
As I mentioned, I had my PhD at Hong Kong U, and I was very lucky to have my PhD under the supervision of Professor Ken Hannon. And I had a very peculiar academic journey, because I majored in international business in my undergrad and postgrad studies. This has much to do with the way I came across with corpus linguistics and the way we use corpus to look at language use. After graduation from my MA education, I taught business English in a local university. And at that time, I came across a couple of books and articles on business discourse, like those written by Vijay Bhatia. And I noticed, you know, in the international community, people are using corpus in the research of business discourse. So I was very interested in corpus linguistics, and especially the way language can be examined by using corpus linguistics, linguistics. And because previously I written papers on business discourse, just reflective articles, not empirical papers. So I was very amazed at corpus linguistics. And then I attended a corpus workshop in Beijing before I moved to Hong Kong for my PhD study. And in that workshop, I learned some basic hands-on skills of basic corpus techniques, like keyword analysis, concordancing, collocations, etc. And then I think Professor Ken Hannon inspired me to use corpus into the research of academic discourse, because I was amazed at the way he writes about academic discourse, not the way he used corpus techniques, but the way he writes about academic discourse, especially the way he interprets the reason why different authors from different disciplines write in different ways. I think in corpus studies, data and quantitative results are one thing. I think the more important thing is the personal interpretation or researcher ethic interpretation of the results. So what? Why the corpus results are like this? So we have to interpret the reasons behind these language use. So I think this is a way as EAP researcher to step forward into the corpus data. So we have to transform these corpus data, corpus results into pedagogical materials, or what we can learn from this corpus analysis into our daily classroom teaching. So what these corpus results can help students write in a good way in different contexts. So this the kind of thing about my academic journey, how I got to learn corpus linguistics and who inspired me in this kind of research.
That's really interesting that at undergraduate, you know, you studied, you said international business, and that transition into, you know, doing something quite different for your PhD project and acquiring new, as you said, you learning the sort of the methodological toolkit, if you will, the tools of the trade in corpus linguistics in preparation for the PhD after sort of studying. That must have been quite difficult making that transition, was it?
Yeah. Because at my PhD application, I proposed to look at business discourse anti-dumping petitions. So I wanted to look at this petition text as my PhD project. But Professor Ken Hannon is an expert in EAP field, not business discourse. So he said, you can choose work in my expertise or on your own topic. Then I switched to to academic discourse, and I got to learn the term shell nouns in the workshop I attended in Beijing. I got to know the term, and I get a sense that nouns are less explored in the literature of EAP discourse. So I moved to the academic discourse. And I mentioned this concept, shell nouns, to Professor Ken Hannant, and he was very happy with the way I wanted to look at noun use in academic discourse, the discipline variations. And he also was happy with the way I tried to map out the functional use of these nouns onto the metadiscursive use of language, because Professor Hannant is an expert in metadiscourse. So he can really help me to work in my proposed new PhD thesis topic. So that's how I switched into academic discourse. And, you know, for us, corpus is a very basic tool, not a theory. So we use a corpus, as Professor Hannant mentioned, we use corpus in a way like a baby search, just a frequency, concordancy, very basic skills. But I think, as I mentioned about, so I think what we want to do is not stop at the quantitative results. So we want to interpret why writers from different disciplines use these nouns in different ways. And so I just I proposed a new term instead of shell nouns, metadiscursive nouns. So I want to emphasize these nouns function in a similar way to metadiscourse in text. So set up personal interpretations between writer and readers. So I look at interactive use of these nouns, cohesive use of these nouns, and interactional use of these nouns, then taking role played by these nouns in discourse. So that's how I switched into this kind of research area. And for corpus use, I learned like a regular expression to search these nouns in the text. So to me, regular expression is more advanced techniques than concordancing or frequency keywords analysis. So I tried to learn how to, you know, came up with the structural searches by these nouns. So like the fact that, so I just search the plus something wildcard search with that. So I look at these kind of structural searches of these nouns in my corpus. I build a corpus myself. So basically, the way I use corpus in my own research is very fundamental. But I think what I'm interested in is go beyond these quantitative results to look at how different disciplines use or produce language in different ways. Yeah, Robbie.
For the benefit of those listening who I hope are interested in corpus linguistics, if you're not, then this may not make much sense at all. But people who are interested in corpus linguistics but maybe not familiar with research in academic discourse, what is a shell noun? It's a great name, but for those who aren't familiar, could you give some examples?
Yeah. Thanks. Shell nouns are proposed by a German psycholinguistic Schmidt, I think. He proposed shell nouns. And he said there's a metaphorical use of shell to name these kind of nouns. These nouns are a specific abstract type of nouns, like a fact. These nouns are a specific. They are abstract categories of nouns. They are a specific in meaning. So the real meaning of these nouns will be retrieved from lexicalization in context, like this fact. So when readers try to understand the meaning of this noun, they have to go back to what this noun encapsulates in the prior context. So these nouns just like eggshells to carry the meaning from the prior segments of text. So like a shell, like eggshells to carry this meaning into forward in the next piece of text. So I think that's why shell nouns is used to name these kind of nouns as specific abstract nouns. And the real meaning of these nouns has to be retrieved from the context, shell nouns. Then I think these nouns work in a similar way to metadiscourse, because one way these nouns play in the text, because they set up a cohesive text, because they refer back to prior text for meaning, for the semantic lexicalization. And at the same time, writers use these kind of nouns to give their stance to the prior information, like this is a fact. So writers think the prior information is a fact, something established, rather than this belief, something very subjective. So I think these kind of nouns play in different ways, two ways, interactive cohesive devices and interactional stance markers in the text. So I think these nouns are very interesting. I remember One of the reviewers of my first paper on IGCL, he said to congratulate me on identifying such a unique but less explored topic in academic writing, because nouns has been considered as objectified use of language. So it refers to entities, so no stance involved in use of nouns. But from my research, these nouns are very rich in authorial evaluation or attitudes, because writers use these nouns to set up personal interpretation and to set up a personal interaction and a given stance and organizing of a cohesive piece of text. So this is the way I understand shell nouns, their function in discourse.
I see. So IJCL, being the International Journal of Corpus Linguistics, sounds like they were happy to receive your first piece of research on this topic. Yes. There'll be lots of people, as I said in the introduction, who listen to this podcast, who are themselves academic writers in one form or another. And I know that it maybe isn't appropriate to talk of it as one solid genre with, you know, no internal variation. But starting broadly, with those who are, you know, who are doing academic writing, what do you see as the main challenges with learning this this genre, if you will?
Yeah, I think the main challenges I had and my students are having may rest in the very persuasive and logical organization of a recent paper. I think writing in an academic style is more than a good command of lexis and grammar. It depends on the way writers cater to readers' rhetorical expectations and processing needs. So it's very much like reader-oriented composition of a text, because you are talking to your readers in the discipline. So you have to write in a way that your readers find familiar, plausible, accessible, and persuasive. So novice writers like and students only focus on, you know, lexical and grammatical choices in a sentence. So, and they ignore the whole picture of what they want to say in each section and the overarching structure of a whole academic story. And the way he can connect each section into a whole picture of an academic story. So I always suggest to my students, don't lose forest for trees, because academic writing in a good way, is not only in a correct lexical and grammatical choices. It's much a way to gratify your readers' expectations and processing needs. Like Chinese, I think Chinese feature a reader responsible writing culture. So Chinese students always write in the assumption that if I understand, my readers understand. This is not true, because writing was likened to ballroom dancing by Michael Foy, and was likened to hand clapping by Job Thompson. So writing is a way to to cater to your reader's need, you know. So you have to anticipate what your reader wants to understand from each sentence, from each segment of a text. So it's a persuasive interaction. It's not only a data reporting, so it's a persuasive interaction. So I think this is a way novice reader find challenging, you know, in composing a very cohesive and logical organization of text, because they only want to report what they found, but they ignore the whole picture, you know, what they want to say about your research. So that's really challenging to novice writers. And as I said in my teaching classroom, I think a good academic paper depends on three elements. The first one is logical consistency from introduction, literature review, method, results, and concluded. So you have to present to your readers a very good logic. It's a logical argumentation. And I always use hourglass shape to tell my students what a good research paper looks like. It's a kind of hourglass shape. from beginning very general to your specific topic, and then to the method you use and to the results. And the way you discuss your result, you have to interact with literature in the field. That's why it's a triangle shape. So it's from your specific research to the literature, and in the bottom, so you have to jump back to the beginning, the field point. So this is the hourglass shape. And the first, that was the first element of a good paper. The second one, I think, is empirical adequacy. So you have to be sure about the way you use corpus to fully support the research question you ask in your research. So that's empirical adequacy. The last element, I think, is disciplinary relevance. Like my students look at stance markers like first person pronouns, I, we, our, whatever. No, they compare research articles in linguistics and biology. I think that research is a good design, but it's not publishable because it's not relevant to your discipline readers, because your readers will know the result without reading your articles, because there's so much literature in the field about comparison between soft and hard disciplines. They're writing different ways, so they don't need to read your articles. They will guess the results, what the results are like. So it's not relevant in this to your disciplinary readers. So the last element, I think, is disciplinary relevance. So these are the things that students need to know how to write a good academic paper. And the first thing, as I mentioned, is the logical consistency, the structure, organization of your paper. So that's my opinion about writing in a good academic style.
Yeah, and I think a testament to the challenges associated with academic writing, learning how to write in this way, we haven't even mentioned anything to do with the citation of sources and referencing and all of the formatting conventions, which in and of themselves can be challenging, and there are lots of different types. And also, of course, the broader issue of academic integrity, which is a really hot topic at the moment in the context of AI and ChatGPT and things like that. And there are lots of I think changes probably coming in the future, not only, well, for academic writing, but a lot of other contexts as well. This is really interesting, though, because it's very meta, I guess, what you're doing, right? You are an academic writer as part of what you do, and you are researching academic writing, and you are producing academic writing, writing about academic writing. So it's very meta. Let's go back in time a bit. What's the history? At what point in the study of linguistics or applied linguistics? How far back do you go to sort of trace when researchers started to do this sort of meta linguistic research about the genre of writing that they themselves are using themselves?
Yeah, I think EAP academic writing is one of branch of EAP studies. I think EAP and ESP study emerged in 1960s when British Council supported the student from developing countries to study in UK. And in research side, scholars like Michael Halliday and Peter Stevens, they look at the new study needs beyond the traditional and general ELT teaching demands. So I think that's how EAP and ESP emerged as a subfield of applied linguistics. And in terms of EAP studies or academic writing studies itself, according to John Swales, the first study in EAP or in academic writing is done by Jonathan Bopper back in 1962. And the title of the paper of her paper, Charles Barber, back in 1962. And the title of her paper is Some Measurable Characteristics of Scientific Prose. And she looked at three scientific texts, and she manually checked up these scientific texts, and she found 28% of lexical verbs were in passive forms, and 25% of these passive forms were in present tense. So I think the research of academic writing, research of academic text, go hand in hand with the empirical epistemology of corpus linguistic at the beginning. Although at that time, corpus would not explicitly use, or you know, we are not aware of corpus at that time, back in 1960s. So, and right now, I think corpus linguistic really help us. It gives us a very easy, convenient access to these pattern distribution, frequency, and function of language use in academic text. And another good way that corpus linguistic can give us is about the natural occurring feature of these language use in a given context. As we mentioned, a corpus briefly is a large collection of natural occurring texts in a given context. So it's natural occurring in a given context. Use the language, the language use it represents are the language use made by different individuals, not only one individuals. And when we talk about writing in an academic discipline or writing in an academic context, we mentioned it is a reader-oriented composition of text. So we always talk about discourse community. So corpus represents individuals' use of language, not a individual preference in this idiosyncratic language use. So it represents language use, or it's the automaticity of language use accepted by the disciplinary, accepted by the community members, not only one person's language use. So this is another good way to use a corpus in our research of academic writing. It really represents the way community accepts, you know, in terms of language use. So I think this advantage that corpus linguistics can give to us when we look at language use in an academic context.
And let's talk about this some more then, you know, that building a corpus of academic writing. You said that, you know, you select the context and you're looking for samples of evidence of language use in that naturally sort of occurring context. But clearly there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of academic journal articles and books and other publications, conference proceedings, abstracts, all sorts of things, all over the place. In English, especially, you know, English is you know, very prominently placed in terms of academic publication as a language. How do you even begin to kind of develop what we would call a sampling frame, I suppose, and selecting the texts and then gathering them together and building the corpus? What does that look like in your own work?
Yeah, always bear in mind the three kind of parameters in corpus building: representativeness, balance, and sampling. So for representativeness, I have to use impact. I have to convince my readers why the journals I choose can really represent that discipline. Like if I want to look at academic text in applied linguistics, I have to choose some journal articles. So I have to convince my readers why the journals I use can really represent applied linguistics. If I only use Tissot Quarterly or Modern Language Journal, these are only educational strands of applied linguistics, not language studies. So I have to convince my readers why the journals I use really represent that discipline. So I use impact factor. Impact factor is a standard way to evaluate how the journal is accepted by the whole community. So I look at the impact factor released by Web of Science according to the 5-year impact factor, which is more reliable. So I choose the first top 10 journals in the field, and I also consult deep professors in each discipline to see which journal you think is really can represent your discipline. So I always use this kind of practice to make sure the text I collected can really represent what I want to research. And then balanced, so I have to, you know, make a good decision about authorship of academic text, because in the academic world, co-authorship is very common, especially in the sciences. So I use 5% of single author text, another 5% of multi-author text. And for social sciences right now, I think collaboration is also trendy. So I have to balance. It make a balance between authorship, 50% of a single author, another 50% of multi-authors. And really, research shows us, you know, different authorship have very big impact on the language use, like self-mentioned, first-person pronouns, and even titles. Because recently, I published a paper on titles in research articles with Professor Ken Hannes, and I investigated some literatures on our title, on the writing of titles. And there is a study found that different authorship has a different impact on the way titles can be write, because people will disagree on the title, so that the title will reshape. So balance is really a thing we should consider when we build up our corpus. And the last one, sampling. Because previously, I just say I use a random sampling in my data collection. And sometimes I met with two reviewers, I think, from my submission. They asked me, how you did your random sampling? How the sampling is random? So it's quite challenging. Then after that, It's a quite challenging question to me. Then after that, when I collected my text, build up my corpus, so if I want like 100 texts for each disciplinary corpus, then I collected 200, double size of the original number. So like 200 texts. And then I order these journal articles alphabetically. Then I choose the first 100 texts as my corpus data. So that kind of gives me one way to make sure a random sampling in my data collection.
Is that random? I don't know. Is it maybe, as you mentioned the titles before, and one of the conventions that you see an awful lot, I'm sure in lots of fields, but you see it in corpus linguistics, is, you know, quotes, maybe a quote from the data, colon, and then more formal title. Is there any chance that, you know, maybe there's certain, I mean, this could be complete rubbish, I don't, you tell me, certain topics or disciplines of application that lend themselves to being earlier in the alphabet and the titles, or in your experience, does that approach of alphabetically ordering the titles, does that produce, you know, is it really random?
Yeah. These are good practices, but you know, I couldn't think about these ways to make sure a random sampling. Mm-hmm. Then what I think about is, you know, use the titles. I just collect the double size of the number of texts I wanted, and then I alphabetically order these texts. I choose the first 100 maybe from the collection as my dot corpus data. Yeah. Then the reviewers were happy with my explanation. So I think it's maybe it's a better way to make sure a sampling is a random.
Absolutely. And you know, we've mentioned earlier about once you've got the corpus and you talked through some of the methods that you apply and in investigating sort of from a, I guess, a functional perspective, you know, how a certain meta discourse sort of features being used to guide the reader. Would you say that your work is solely interested in investigating these features in academic writing in order to help people to learn academic writing, or are there other applications that you're also interested in?
The journal I always publish is a journal of English for academic purposes and English for specific purposes. These journals are pedagogy-based journals because the original founding editors, like Professor Ken Hannan and John Swills, they are interested in pedagogy of EAP. So you have to think about how you can transform your corpus results into pedagogical applications. So one way of I can think of my corpus data is raised students' awareness of user language, you know, responsive to the context, responsive to the disciplinary context, disciplinary writers, or disciplinary readers, or genres. These kind of things I have think of. Another way I think I can think of the possible application of my corpus data is kind of data-driven learning. So I use my results to design some tests on practical activities to students, and they will investigate the meta-discursive use of a language in disciplinary texts themselves. So I try to transform these results into data-driven learning activities, and also maybe try to think about how I can use my corpus results into the ways textbooks can be better written, like EAP textbooks. Because right now in China, corpus is quite a good way to increase the reliability of your research. So, and also their publishers want to publish textbooks based on corpus data, like EAP textbooks. So I also want to try to think about the way my research suggests good classroom activities and ways to learn academic language use in these textbooks.
I see. Yes. No, that does make sense on that sort of broader aim of bringing the data back into the teaching context.
Yep.
I know that there's a lot of research in that area in data-driven learning.
Sorry, I just turned off the light.
That's okay. No problem. We'll keep rolling. You've mentioned a couple of times already, of course, Ken Hyland, who was your PhD supervisor and a huge name in this and sort of related fields. You recently published a paper with him about informality in academic writing. I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about that. Is it the case that academic writing is becoming less formal over time?
Yeah, the answer is yes. Academic writing is becoming less formal. We found like 2% increase of these informal features we look at in our corpus. Our corpus was based on published research articles. And I think we found the most increased features are first-person pronouns and attended reference, like this, not this, plus now, that this, attended reference. I'm not sure if you have heard of attended this, attended this, proposed by Joss Wales. These and attended use of these. And also starting a sentence starting with conjunctions. These three features that we found registered the most increase in published academic text. And the increase, 2% increase, were also found in science text. Because in science text, there are increase of informal features. But in applied linguistics and sociology and the soft disciplines, they change the way around. It's quite interesting, I think. And I think this suggests the way changing academic context has a really big impact on the way language is used. So published research articles is not always frozen in language use, because we always think academic genres are established type of text will not change. It's so conventional, but it's not true. From our corpus result, we can say the language use in these published texts are changing gradually in response to the changing academic context. And we have to emphasize here that these corpus data are published research articles. So that means these texts having gone through editing, reviewing process. So the change we found suggests that the community gatekeepers are happy with this change, are subscribing to this informal user language. So this also can indicate the way disciplinary community are responsive to the changing social context. I think one of the change of social context is happened in sciences. As I mentioned, science texts shown increased use of these informal features, because previously, traditionally, we think scientific texts are faceless, dry, and objective, but now they are inventing more informal features and more kind of personal interactions. We also, Professor Han and I has published a number of papers on different aspects of language use in this diachronic text. So we found when we look at meta discourse informal features, all these studies suggest that sciences are using more interactive features in this kind of traditionally coded text. I think this suggests the changing way of context in sciences. One of the most dramatic change is a changing audience, a changing readership, the changing audience. Right now in sciences, readers are not always the peer researchers in the focus of field, because scientific results have to reach out to new audience, to new stakeholders. You know, different people will have different interests in these scientific results, like investors, governments, people, whatever. So there are so many new audience involved in sharing of scientific articles. I remember one of the stories that my roommate told me when I had my PhD at Hong Kong U. My roommate is a PhD student in engineering, electronical engineering, and his project was about a design of a cell phone antenna. He told me after he had published his article, he and his supervisor went to Shenzhen to sell the antenna they designed to these cell phone companies. So if the boss of the cell phone companies are happy with their design, they will buy the patent of their design. So I think the readers of scientific results are changing. So they have to kind of change the way language is used.
That's really interesting, and I think you're right, and certainly in my experience, and I think I see it in my students as well. There's a gap between the perception of what academic writing is and what it actually is. And I certainly remember when I started studying university, thinking that good academic writing meant, you know, making it as complex and inaccessible as possible, and using rare words that you know some people might not know. And then as my academic writing, you know, we're always learning, but between then and now, as it has improved in that time, the thing I've noticed more than anything is that I'm trying to be as clear and simple in terms of making the writing accessible, which almost goes against the stereotype about academic writing, but what you're saying makes sense in that more people from different areas of reading, it's less specialist maybe now.
Yeah, true. I remember Michael Halliday described academic language as elite language. But right now, because of changing audienceship, I also noticed some journals in sciences, in the description of the language, of the aim and interest of the journal or author guidelines, you know, proposed by the journals, they mentioned, please use active language to promote scientific communication. So these journals are also concerned about, you know, this abstract language use, which is hard to understand to this, you know, to this everyday lay person, you know. So I think this is a way language changed in academic context. Yeah. I think this is one of the reasons why we found there's an increase in informal features in science writing.
Okay, now, as we start to wrap up here, we're about to move into our quick question section. But before that, I'm going to put you on the spot. And this is just asking your personal opinion. It doesn't need to be informed by your research. Within the field of corpus linguistics, is or are there any particular researchers in the field whose academic writing you sort of prefer or find to be, you know, that's really sort of accessible or well written? Or are there any academic writers in corpus linguistics that you particularly admire?
Sorry, Robert, could you repeat your question? I didn't hear it clearly. Sorry, Robert.
Yeah, no problem. So I'm going to put you on the spot here, and I'm going to ask you your opinion. Thinking about the field of corpus linguistics, are there any writers in terms of academic writing in corpus linguistics that you especially admire for having what you deem to be good, really good academic writing?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Robbie, for this question. The only person I can think of is Professor Ken Hannon. He's a very powerful writer. And I think for novice writers, maybe we might as well not copy the way Professor Ken Hannon, this established scholars, write, because they are so powerful. So sometimes they will not really strictly follow these academic conventions, like in methods sections of research articles. You will find sometimes they don't write in the way as we expected in academic writing, because these are established top researchers in the field. So we have to, I think I always suggest my students, follow the way novice writers to write. And this is one person, I'm not sure if you have heard of this, his name, Peter Crosswaite. In Queensland, he used to work at Hong Kong U, and right now he's working in Queensland. And I think he used corpus in a way, you know, really support us like novice writers write in academic text. So he's the second person that I can think of, you know, really use corpus data, corpus and results to support young people and novice writers write.
Okay, well, there we go, hot off the press. thank you for indulging me in asking you that. Okay, we are now going to move to our final part of the episode, quick questions. One of them is a little bit different. We'll get to that in a moment. But our first quick question is, what is the biggest change you've noticed in corpus research during your career?
Yeah, I noticed kind of two changes in corpus research throughout my career. Not really throughout my career, just you know, throughout my personal story of publishing papers, you know, my experiences. The first one, right now, journals are asking for more vigorous statistical treatments on data results. You know, previously we just report like local likelihoods, these statistical text on, you know, statistical meaning of a comparison, like so hard disciplines use less features than soft disciplines. We use a text to prove that difference is statistically significant. But right now I notice some reviewers are asking for effect size or other kind of, you know, statistical text to further support your results. You know, I think this is one of the change. They are asking for more vigorous statistical treatments on our corpus results. The second one is they are also asking for more advanced technical treatments. Like right now, people are using Python, all these AI techniques, you know, or sentiment analysis, these word to vec, this kind of more advanced, more automated search of a large corpus. So sometimes reviewers are asking for, you know, a more advanced treatment of your corpus, you know. But I think it relates to the research questions we ask in our paper. I think research questions are the guiding principle which can guide our whole study. You know, the method we use are dependent on the research question we ask. If the method we use can fully answer the question we ask, that's okay. We don't need to, you know, use a new tool, use a new method just to show how fancy it is. So I think we use methods, you know, in response to the research question we ask in the paper. So this is the second change I noticed, you know, they are asking for more advanced technical treatment.
Yeah, I completely agree. I definitely see that too. And this is a topic that a lot of my guests have touched upon in response to that question. So you're not alone in that opinion. Second question is a new one just for you. So you're the first person to tackle this one. You have already touched upon this, so I think I know where you're going, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Quick question number two, corpus linguistics, method or theory?
Yeah, I think corpus linguistics to me is a method. It's a tool and also a method. Also, I mentioned associated with the outlook we take on language. So it's a tool. Because for EAP researchers, we use corpus to look at language use in a more convenient way. So I think the job of EAP researchers is to go beyond corpus data to interpret the meaning, the social meaning behind this corpus data, and how we can transform this corpus tool to our daily classroom. I think this reminds me of a sentence written by John Swales. He mentioned, for EAP researchers, we use methods which make sense in our pedagogical environment. So corpus is one of way to facilitate our pedagogical teaching. So it's a tool to me, not a theory.
Okay. We'll see what people make of that. There might be some who sit on the other side of the fence. We'll see. Final quick question before we wrap things up today. How will corpus linguistics make an impact on the world in the future?
Yeah, I think corpus linguistics will make impact on different aspects of the world in the future. And we have also already seen many researchers use corpus in law studies to look at linguistic evidence behind a crime, like Cothard, back in 1990s, to use corpus to look at linguistic evidence, and also communication, like we look at for example, like COVID news. In COVID news, we look at maybe a keyword China. We look at how people from different countries to communicate, you know, different values of on the story. So communication is the one way. Another one, maybe literature, like Michelle Meilberg used corpus techniques to look at Dickinson's fictions. So corpus stylistics, literature. And in education side, I think after, you know, in the post-COVID times, we use corpus to support students learning and online learning. Because in the post-COVID times, online learning is very common, and we use corpus to design, to guide our online teaching, like DDL I mentioned. It's quite new in China, I think. There are people are using corpus in design DDL activities. And also in China, we're now having one of the new drive of new liberal arts drive. We want to support our traditional research in humanities with more scientific techniques. I think corpus can be one way to support traditional humanities research in the new direction. So it really has a big impact on our world. And right now, in this winter, ChatGPT and GPT-4 are released. I think they are changing our whole world. I think the basic principle, the theory, basic theory behind these ChatGPT and GPT-4 techniques, I think they have the same theory with corpus linguistics, co-occurring of items in a given context. That's how machine can learn the way they produce information. So behind these kind of tools, they are the theory are the same. So corpus linguistics will really change the way we use language and the way we research language.
So we're seeing an ever-increasing range of applications. And a few of the topics you mentioned, we've already discussed in previous episodes of CorpusCast. So do go back if you want to hear about forensic linguistics. We had members of the Aston Institute for Forensic Linguistics. We had Michaela Malberg on talking about stylistics. So it's nice to hear that we've touched on some of the things that you see developing further in the future. Okay, well, we will draw things to a close there. Thank you so much, Kevin. This has been really great,
Robbie,
to get to chat with you and hear more about you and your work. So that is all for today's episode of CorpusCast. Thank you for joining us, our listeners. However you've accessed us, whether that's on YouTube, Spotify, Google Podcast, Podcast Addict, or Podchaser, do come back for the next episode, where I'll be joined by Dr. Jesse Egbert and Dr. Tove Larsen at Northern Arizona University. They'll have plenty to discuss on corpus linguistics, I'm sure. In the meantime, why not subscribe and let us know your thoughts on this and other episodes using the hashtag CorpusCast. Make sure to check out the Aston Corpus Linguistics Research Group on Twitter at Aston Corpus, and you can follow me at Lovermob. So thanks again. CorpusCast is an Aston Originals podcast written and hosted by me, Robbie Love, and produced by my excellent colleague of high esteem, Sam Cook, from our press and communications team. Thank you, Sam, as always. Thanks again for listening. Thanks to you, most of all, Kevin Jiang from Jillian University.
That's been your Robbie intervention.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, and we'll see you soon on the next episode of CorpusCast. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.